Protests, shortages and a state of emergency. What's behind the dire economic crisis in Sri Lanka? Can the country's finances be salvaged? And what will the political consequences be if they aren't? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Sami Zeidan. Now, Sri Lanka is going through its worst economic crisis in more than seven decades. The country's usable foreign currency reserves have plunged below $1 billion, limiting its ability to repay loans. And traders can't get dollars to buy imports. Well, over the weekend, the government imposed a curfew after violent demonstrations broke out. Protesters are angry over unprecedented shortages of food, fuel and medicine. But opposition parliament members have defied the curfew to march in the capital. Some are calling for the president to step down. Minel Fernandez has this report from Colombo.
Emergency regulations, a 36-hour curfew, and special new rules preventing people from gathering in public places failed to silence people's voices. And protests like this, you're hearing the horns behind me, all coming together despite the curfew to express their anger and frustration against the current government. I mean, some of the signs, even within this group, it's Go Home Rajapaksa with 225. That's a nod to the 225 representatives in parliament. It says create a wave, a Go Home Gotha. These are the sort of taglines or slogans of this public demonstration that we're seeing across the country. Not just here in the capital, Colombo, but around the country. Now, the economic problems that brought Sri Lanka to its knees and now directly impacting ordinary Sri Lankans in the form of skyrocketing prices of their essential goods, rice, dal, milk powder, as well as cooking gas, of fuel. Even those who have the money can't actually source them. They spend hours in long queues. And what people say is, while this is obviously not a Sri Lanka sort of specific phenomenon, the world is facing problems after the corona pandemic, that the mismanagement by the Sri Lankan government, the failure to admit that it was having problems, as well as corruption, has aggravated the situation. So that's why there is this anger, and Sri Lanka is trying, it's scrambling to try and deal with these issues, but they're in for the long haul. Minel Fernandez for Inside Story.
Let's examine what's turned Sri Lanka's foreign debt burden into an unprecedented economic crisis. Its tourism sector, a major foreign exchange earner, was battered by the Easter attacks in 2019 and the pandemic. And now, two countries that are vital to its tourist market are at war. Russia and Ukraine had been the first and third largest source of visitors this year. A failed drive to become the first country to farm entirely organically also hurt food supplies. Sri Lanka was forced to import rice. The tea crop, the nation's top export, was devastated. Sri Lanka wants China, a major lender, to restructure its debt, and it secured a $1 billion relief package from India. Let's bring in our guests. They're all in Colombo. Harsha De Silva is a Member of Parliament. He represents the main opposition party, SJB. Bhavani Fonseca, a senior researcher and attorney at law with the Centre for Policy Alternatives. And W.A. Wijewardena is a columnist at the Daily Financial Times and a former deputy governor of the Central Bank of Sri Lanka. A warm welcome to all of you. If I could start with Harsha. So, looking at it, what's caused this economic crisis? Can it be pinned on one specific factor?
Yes, I think it can be pinned on two factors. One is the unprecedented and totally unnecessary tax cut of 2019 December. The revenue that would have come into the treasury fell by about one-third, or in Sri Lankan currency, about 600 billion rupees per year. And in order to fill the gap in the treasury, the central bank started printing money, and that started a downward spiral in the economic management. And we got downgraded by the credit rating agencies globally and shut the door to international financial markets. That led to the government going into the reserves to pay back debt, and that caused multiple problems in the macroeconomy. The other specific decision was the banning of the import of chemical fertilizer, which then led to, in some places, up to 70% of the harvest being lost. So both put together, and also a debt overhang problem that we had for a long period of time, created this toxic combination,
okay,
which has now created a massive problem in the economy.
Perhaps not entirely a surprise, since, of course, you represent the opposition perspective that, you know, you're highlighting there the failures of government. If I could bring in Bhavani, is it more deep-rooted than simply the failures of this government? Is it also a convergence of other factors that perhaps are outside the government's control, like, let's not forget, the collapse in commodity prices, the economic fallout of the pandemic lockdowns, the 70% fall in tourism after the 2019 bombings, the rising cost of fuel because of the war in Ukraine, and so on and so forth?
So, Sami, I think there are multiple combinations, but at this moment, I mean, we are in crisis mode. The main reason why we have this crisis is purely due to the mismanagement of this government. Yes, there are other reasons, but the government had an indicator that we were heading down this direction. They could have taken steps way
before. What could they have done? Let me jump in here. I'm going to try and play devil's advocate to present the government's perspective. What more could the government have done, though, when they've got all those other factors that I mentioned going on, from a war in Ukraine, the pandemic, the collapse in commodity prices? I mean, isn't there a limit to how much you can wave that magic wand when you're in government?
Well, Sami, let's start with one thing. The tax cuts that happened was in December 2019. There was information even at that time that was not a smart move. 2.5 years later, there is now a slight realization that was a mistake. The policy in terms of the fertilizer ban, that happened also early on, and there was information from experts saying this was not a smart move. Yes, we needed to transition to organic fertilizer, but you can't do these things overnight. So in a sense, the government promised so many things in 2019 and 2020 during the election cycles, but failed to deliver on their own promises, failed to listen to experts who are advising on measures that could have been taken. Granted, the pandemic raised unprecedented challenges, but this was in 2020. 2022, we're still grappling with some of the basic fundamental challenges. One of the other things I would say is the government's own decision to take back a lot of powers from Parliament. So under the 20th Amendment, which was enacted in 2020, it's a very executive heavy government right now. And whereas if you had a system where both the president and the parliament could work together, that would be also something that could have prevented or mitigated some of these things. So it's a very heavy, executive heavy, very powerful government, but they have failed to take very basic fundamental steps that they could have taken because the warning signs are very early on. So now it's a bit too late.
Okay. Let's bring in W.A. Wijewardena. So the result now is that we're looking at what? Power cuts, fuel shortages, food shortages, medicine shortages. Add to that, of course, things like rising inflation. I think it reached 17.5% in February, according to the central bank. Unemployment's rising too. I mean, how unbearable is life becoming for Sri Lankans?
Well, of course, you have very correctly gone through this scorecard of Sri Lanka today. But I agree with both Harsha and Bhavani when they say that the present crisis has been mainly due to the policy errors made by the present government. As a result of these policy errors, Sri Lanka has now come to an explosive position, and all the people in the country, not only the common man in the street, but all the people in the country have been hit in their purse as well as in their stomach. Their purse has been hit because they have lost the income, substantial part of their income. Even the rich people have lost because of the loss in the their company activities and various economic activities. And their stomach has been hit because of the rising food prices. So as a result, this type of a situation is a very fertile ground for the people to come to street and make agitations. So they have been actually hit by the increase in the prices, because when you said that the current inflation rate is 17.7%, compiled by the Department of Census Statistics, but the true inflation is much more than that, because the food inflation is about 30% and the particular price index compiled by the Census Department has used a very low weight for the food category, only 28%. So, but if you take the normal food budget of a normal family, which amounts to about, say, 45% of their budget, the actual true inflation in terms of the present consumer price index is about 20 to 22%. But that is not the case, because when the people have to stand in a queue for long hours, about 8 to 10 hours to get their essential requirements, we have to add the cost of standing in a queue also to the money price that they pay. And when we take all these factors into account, the true inflation in Sri Lanka is about, say, 100% today. And that is why people have come to the street and they're agitating, and those agitations have been spontaneous. They have not been led or orchestrated by any political party. So it has spread to the throughout of the country, and we are now witnessing it as at its worst today in Sri Lanka.
All right, let's bring in Harsha again. Let's talk about the solution, Harsha. Will Sri Lanka be forced to turn to the IMF for another loan? Is that where the country is heading?
Well, actually, we should have gone to the IMF at the end of 2020 at the very least, or perhaps earlier. Now, going just to the IMF is not going to resolve our problems, because we are unable to pay our debt. So our debt needs to be restructured. Our taxes need to go up. Our expenditures need to be rationalized. Our budget deficits need to be cut. Then the central bank and the entire monetary board needs to be sacked, including the governor. New appointments need to be made, and money printing needs to stop. They need to manage the exchange rate in such a way so that people are able to purchase imported goods. And finally, we need to make sure that the poor people in this country, the low-income people, people with disabilities, people who are finding it hard to make ends meet, have a social safety net so that these reforms can go through. So all of these things need to happen to stabilize the macro economy, and then a whole restructuring effort needs to be undertaken. So Essentially, Sri Lanka needs to be reset.
All right, but even if we do those sorts of things, Bhavani, I mean, is it enough simply sacking officials and cutting budgets and austerity measures now? I mean, Sri Lanka has something like $4 billion in debt payments this year. It's going to need some money, or it's going to default, right? Isn't that, unfortunately, what it's facing?
Yeah, I think the debt repayment is a bit higher than 4 billion, but I'll leave it to the economists to come on that. But the challenges are multiple and many. And actually, as I speak to you, I'm facing a power cut. I mean, this is the new reality in Sri Lanka, is that the multiple challenges that people have to go through. And I think it's very important to understand what any civilian has to face on a day-to-day, from looking to essential food items, to medicine, to figuring out what time the power cuts are, to trying to find fuel. And one other thing that is very important to remember, is we are now in a state of emergency. And I can't reiterate this enough, because a state of emergency means the executive has a lot of power. So these multiple challenges, the question is, who is going to be deciding and coming up with proposals? If you look at the last 2.5 years since Gotabaya Rajapaksa came into power, as I mentioned before, there's been a strong effort to consolidate power to a point of authoritarianism in Sri Lanka. It's now very important, in addition to addressing the economic challenges and the debt restructuring and structural reforms, it's also important to look at institutions, democratic processes. Why does Sri Lanka keep going back to this notion of emergency, having to declare emergency at any given time? Because if we had systems in place, if we had experts in place, and the executive listened to these people and took note of this, we wouldn't be in this mess. So it's a very, it's very much looking at the human side of this crisis, but also looking at the structural reforms that are required. And that's not going to happen in the short term, in the immediate. So it needs to be long-term.
Definitely not. When you start talking about structural reforms, of course, as we know very well, Bhavani, you're talking, you know, much longer term. W.A. Widyawardena, if the solution is long-term structural reforms and strengthening of institutions in the short term, is there an alternative to IMF money? How far can help and aid from India and China go in helping the country out until it makes those sorts of structural reforms? Is that a possible alternative solution?
Well, of course, without going to IMF right now, Sri Lanka is not in a position to build confidence in the minds of the foreign investors in Sri Lanka.
So India and China cannot fill that confidence void?
No, India and China cannot fill that, because main reason is that they have provided very short-term trade credit to Sri Lanka. And the trade credit will enable Sri Lanka to undertake an import program. But of course, if you look at the total amount that they have lent, India has lent $1.5 billion as trade credit, which is even less than 1 month's imports requirements of the country. Same thing is true with China, because China had earlier lent 10 billion yuan, which was equal to $1.5 billion, which could have been used only for importing goods from China.
But then, so to Harsh's point, W.A., why would another IMF loan be the solution? I think the country's had 16 IMF loans so far. Why would this one work?
Well, of course, you know, we'll have to now make it very clear. IMF is a necessary condition for a country to come out of an economic catastrophe, but not a sufficient condition. That is because IMF provides relief to the central bank to manage its balance of payments by providing a loan to the central bank. But for us to take it further and reach the long-term economic sustainability, we have to undertake economy-wide reform program, which includes all types of, you know, reforming all types of government institutions, budget, central bank, and as Harsha said, you know, even the agriculture sector. All these things will have to be done by the government of Sri Lanka. In the past, what happened was the Sri Lankan authorities had got the IMF loan, and they had just gone through the hurdle of the balance of payments crisis. But they failed to implement the reform program to take Sri Lanka to the high income growth. So this time also, we run the same risk if we just, you know, stick to a loan from the IMF and ignore all other reforms that have to be, you know, undertaken by the country. Now, one important reform program which the IMF vision that came to Sri Lanka under this article for consultation was that IMF has recommended that Sri Lanka's central bank's independence should be maintained by enacting the bill that had been drafted early and that had been presented to parliament while Harsha Sivala was one of the ministers there. And that particular bill was shelved by the Gotabaya Rajapaksa administration. And IMF has now recommended that bill should be immediately enacted, which should actually ensure the independence of the central bank and the depoliticization of the central bank activities. That is why Harsha Sirisena was very strong, and he said all the people in the central bank should be sacked. But we don't have to sack them. What we have to do is to, we have to ensure the independence of the central bank by enacting the bill that had been shelved by the Gotabaya Rajapaksa administration. And by doing that, what we do is actually we will make the central bank an agent of the government, which should provide very productive and constructive advice to the government. Right now, what has happened is central bank has become a subservient, yielding hand to whatever the policy errors the government is committing. Okay. So that has to be stopped. And that is why we need the IMF today.
Okay, let me bring in Harsha, though. And Harsha, if we ask the question this way, should we not also be reaching the conclusion that neoliberalism is failing Sri Lanka? I understand all the faults and failures of the government in mishandling the tax reforms, in mishandling the farming reforms, and so on. But when you've done the same thing 16 times and given the country 16 different loans and you expect a different outcome, doesn't that say something about your thinking as well, if you keep giving this money and getting the same outcome?
Well, I need to correct one thing. What Mr. Vijayawardena has said is I am not asking the entire central bank to be sacked. I'm asking that the entire monetary board to be replaced with a monetary board that can bring in confidence, because there is a crisis of confidence and all markets will fail. Markets will become inefficient. Markets will freeze if there is no confidence in the investors in Sri Lanka. So that's what I meant. But I want to go back to your question of neoliberalism. I don't agree, because over the last so many years, 73 years, and we started going to the IMF in 1965, you know, we've had different ideologies and we have different governments rule this country. So some were socialist, some were neoliberal. So therefore, you know, you can't just say it is the ideology of a particular government, because various governments had not been able to do the kinds of reforms Mr. Vijayawardena referred to. What I believe is that we need to create what I call a social market economy, where it is a synthesis of economic liberalism and political liberalism, in that the markets always win. You know, you have to make, you know, you have to, you know, agree with the fact that no politician nor a bureaucrat can direct markets. So we have to ensure the incentive structures are present in such a way that the economy is driven or led in a particular direction. And political liberalism, I hear, mean social justice. And that is most important, because people are unable to survive. And it is embarrassing, because we were a upper middle income country. And we don't need to beg from various countries, 250 million, 500 million.
Understood. Harsha, let me jump in and let me bring in Bhavani, because I think we've got about a minute left. Can the Rajapaksa government survive, talking about survival, Bhavani?
Well, it needs to be more than survival, Sammy, because I think we've got to a situation, it's not just the survival of a particular family or a particular government. And this is why it's so important for the government, for the opposition, for all stakeholders to come on board.
But do you think the president will step down and resign?
Well, that's up to the president, but there's a lot of pressure building even today, despite the curfew. People were on the streets calling for his resignation, for the family to leave. So there is considerable, significant high anger among the people for the missing up of the country, the economy, the political situation by one family. And I think that needs to be very clear. The blame is on this government, but particularly the president and the family. But one person cannot address this alone. That's why I keep coming back to, there needs to be systems in place, there needs to be structures. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to address this problem.
All right, we'll leave it there. I'm afraid we are out of time, but it's been a great chat. Let's thank our guests, Harsha Da Silva, Bhavani Fonseca, and W.A. Vijayawardena. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the show again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. For further discussion, head over to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle there is at AJ Inside Story. From me, Sami Zeidan, and the whole team here, for now, it's goodbye.